into a very, very serious, very heavy part of the Gospels. This is extremely sobering, what is taking place here. We've just described how Jesus is praying, stretched out flat on the ground with his face to the dirt, praying here if there's any way for this to pass by him, that he not have to go through what he knows is going to happen, pleading with his Father for this. And of course, the reality is there is no other way. This has to happen. And it has to happen. Why? It has to happen so that we can have the penalty for our sins paid and for us to be able to receive God's gift of salvation. We come to another part here, bottom of page 112 from Luke's account, Luke 22 and verse 43. And this again tells us some of the pressure. It's so easy just to read through what is going on here and not realize the seriousness of this, the pressure that he is feeling. And here we see a couple of indicators of that pressure. At the bottom of page 112, Luke 22, verse 43. Then an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. The mental agony and torment that Jesus is going through at this point is so great that God sends an angel to strengthen him, to help him, to encourage him, to help him to bear up under the pressure and under the stress. And notice continuing in verse 44, and being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And this is something that has puzzled people for a number of years. Notice it says here, he is in agony. This word means absolute mental torment. It's like being tortured, except it's mental at this point. He's not physically tortured at this point. So this tells us some of how stressful this is. And again, the pressure and the stress are reaching unimaginable levels to the point that God literally sends an angel to help him through this, to strengthen him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. Then his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And Luke, it's interesting, Luke records this. Luke is a physician. He's a doctor. And he records something here that none of the other gospel writers note. So this word agony means struggling severely in anguish. And the physical torture will come later, but it's the mental torture that comes first. The emotional and the mental torture. People have puzzled over this great drops of blood. Sweat is like great drops of blood. And you may have heard a phrase in the English language, sweating blood. That's where this comes from here. And people have puzzled over this for years, but it is a very real medical condition. Don't need you to spell this. It's called hematidrosis. Hematidrosis, hema from blood, tidrosis. And it's rare, but it does happen when the body is under so much stress, so much pressure, that the tiny blood vessels under the skin are so pressurized, they literally burst the tiny blood vessels under the skin. And the blood leaks out under the surface of the skin into the nearby sweat glands, which are all over our body, and the body literally sweats blood. The blood oozes out with the sweat. And it's only under extreme stress. You can look it up online. It's pretty gory. I have to warn you if you do choose to look it up. But it is real. This was first documented on a large scale, if you've ever seen some of the World War II movies about the Blitz in London, where the German bombers are flying overnight and during the night, and all the Londoners go down into the subway or into bomb shelters, and they hide out there, and the bombs are thumping on the ground, and the dust is falling, and people don't know if the next bomb is going to come through the roof of their shelter, and they're going to be blown to smithereens. And they documented during World War II, people there were just so stressed out, they were literally sweating blood. And this gives us some idea of what Jesus Christ himself is going through at this time. The mental and emotional agony that he is feeling. And this is the kind of relentless and crushing and choking pressure that he is feeling that night there at Gethsemane, that the blood is literally being squeezed out of him. So he knew the awful price that had to be paid for sin, for our sin, for our sin. Verse 45, when he rose up from prayer and had come to his disciples, he found them sleeping from sorrow. Turning to Mark's account, verse 37, the top of page 113, then he came and found them sleeping and said to Peter, Simon, are you sleeping? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Again, he went away and prayed and spoke the same words. Well, what same words? Abba, Father, please let this cup pass from me. I don't want to drink it. Is there any other way this can happen without me having to go through this? But again, there is no other way. Verse 40, and when he returned, he found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. Then he came the third time. So three times Jesus goes away privately to pray for deliverance from this. And he said to them the third time when he comes back, are you still sleeping and resting? It is enough. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. Now we'll continue with John's account. And Judas, who had betrayed him, also knew, this is verse 2 of John 18, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. Then Judas, having received a detachment of troops and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. And here's an illustration up here from the movie, The Passion of the Christ, that came out. Incidentally, how many of you have seen this movie? Okay, quite a few. Okay, all right. I'm going to show you a clip of it tomorrow to illustrate part of this. But notice this is a detachment of troops and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees. I mentioned earlier, these are the temple police. These are not Roman soldiers, as is typically portrayed. And this was captured correctly in the movie. These are the temple guards, the temple police, under the authority of the high priest. They're not the Romans. The Romans aren't involved in it at this point. So notice that previously we've covered a number of times where Jesus slips away from his enemies and escapes, but now he doesn't do that because now the time has come for these prophecies to be fulfilled, and he does not flinch. So they come, and he is ready to be taken, as prophecy says, as a sheep to the slaughter. So this is what is happening. Verse 4, Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that would come upon him, he knows exactly what's going to happen. What does he do? Notice this, he went forward. He goes to them. Previously, he has slipped away, so he would not be killed prematurely. But now he knows the time has come. So he goes forward to meet what he knows is going to happen. And he said to them, whom are you seeking? They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus said to them, I am he. And Judas, who betrayed him, also stood with him. Now when Jesus said to them, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. I should add also here, the he, I am he, the he is added, does not appear in the original. So again, Jesus is, he is the I am, which we've covered a number of times before. He again identifies himself as God, as the I am who spoke with Moses there at the burning bush, the one who interacted with people as God in the Old Testament. Why did they fall to the ground? That's a question that's come up over the years. Obviously, Jesus didn't do anything because he is voluntarily submitting himself to go with them. It seems evident that the Father must have done this or an angel to cause them to fall down. Why? I think, frankly, just to show that God had the power to stop this. Could have struck them all dead, but didn't. Because again, it has to happen this way. It has to happen. Then Jesus asked them again, verse 7, "Whom are you seeking?" And they said, "Jesus of Nazareth." Jesus answered, "I have told you that I am he," or "I am. Therefore, if you seek me, let these go their way, that the saying might be fulfilled, which he spoke, 'Of those whom you gave me, I have lost none.'" So at this moment when he could use more support and friendship, support from his disciples, Jesus tells those who are arresting him, "Let all of these go. You came for me. Take me. Let the rest of them go." Showing again his love and concern for them, even at this point. And what do? They all run away into the night like a bunch of scared rabbits. And they leave him to suffer what is coming alone. Across the page to Matthew's account, verse 48. "Now his betrayer, Judas, had given them a sign, saying, 'Whomever I kiss, he is the one. Seize him.' Immediately, Judas went up to Jesus and said, 'Greetings, Rabbi,' and he kissed him." And it was unthinkable in that day for a student, a Talmidim of a rabbi, to betray his master, because he looked up to his rabbi and his master as even held him in even higher esteem than his own father. And they should love the master, because after all, the whole point of the rabbi-disciple relationship, to repeat it again, the disciple wants to become just like his rabbi in every way. Just like his rabbi. And Judas does what? He betrays his rabbi. Utterly unthinkable in that day. And how does he betray him? With a sign of affection and love. With a kiss. With a kiss. And what is Jesus' reaction then? Verse 50. "But Jesus said to Judas, 'Friend, why have you come?' Then they came and laid hands on Jesus and took him." And as I get choked up every time I read those words. "Friend, why have you come?" Because Judas knew why he had come. And Jesus knew why he had come. And Judas knew that Jesus knew why he had come. But still, Jesus calls him friend. Kind of like the triclinium seating that we talked about last class. Who were in the positions of honor that last night together? John on Jesus' right hand and Judas on his left. Is showing Judas honor and friendship even to the very end. Verse 51, "And suddenly one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand and drew his sword, struck the servant of the high priest, and cut off his ear." This is Simon Peter, continuing with what John says in John 18 and verse 10 at the bottom of the page. Bottom right corner, "Then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it and struck this high priest's servant and cut off his right ear." He wasn't trying to cut off his ear, he's trying to cut off his head, and the man ducks. "And the servant's name was Malchus. So Jesus said to Peter, 'Put your sword into the sheath. Shall I not drink the cup which my Father has given me?'" And Luke's account, we won't read it, but Luke 22, verse 51, Luke again is the doctor. And he records that Jesus healed the servant's ear and made him well again, well and whole again. Continuing, middle of page 115 from Mark's account, Mark 14, 48. "Then Jesus answered and said to them, 'Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me? I was daily with you in the temple teaching, and you did not seize me. But the scriptures must be fulfilled.' Then they all forsook him and fled." All run away into the night and leave Jesus alone. "Now a certain young man followed him, Jesus, followed Jesus, having a linen cloth thrown around his naked body. And the young men laid hold of him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked. And most commentators think that this young man, who has all he's wearing is a linen cloth, and the soldiers try to grab him, and they grab the cloth, and he runs away from it. They think that this is probably Mark himself, that Mark was there and witnessed the events of that evening. And it's not complimentary toward him either, because he runs away into the night just like the rest of them, just like every one of them, to leave Jesus to suffer his fate by himself. Continuing with John's account, John 18, verse 12, bottom of the page, then the detachment of troops and the captain and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him, and they led him away to Annas first, for he was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Now it was Caiaphas who advised the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. And we didn't read that specifically, but he says this, it's expedient that one man die for the people, lest the Romans come in and take their place and their position, lest Jesus start this movement that gains a lot of ground and the Romans bring in their soldiers and destroy the nation. And of course, it will happen a couple of decades after this, but actually Caiaphas was prophesying, foretelling what would happen, that one man should die for the sins of the people, as Jesus did. Verse 19, skipping down a little bit, the high priest then asked Jesus about his disciples and his doctrine. Jesus answered him, I spoke openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where the Jews always meet, and in secret I have said nothing. Why do you ask me? Ask those who have heard me what I said to them. Indeed, they know what I said. And when he had said these things, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus, slapped him, in other words, with the palm of his hand, saying, do you answer the high priest like that? Jesus answered him, if I have spoken evil, bear witness of the evil. But if well, why do you strike me? We see a number of illegalities in this trial, which I don't have time to get into, but some of them are this. They abuse the prisoner. They are having this trial at night, which is illegal under Jewish law. There are a number of other things there that we don't have time to get into. Continuing, page 116, Mark's account, verse 53, and they led Jesus away to the high priest. And with him were assembled all the chief priests, the elders, and the scribes. Now the chief priests and all the council, this is referring to the Sanhedrin, the Jewish legislative / religious body, kind of like a combination Supreme Court and Congress, if you will, they sought testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimonies did not agree. Then some rose up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. But even then their testimony did not agree. So what this is telling us is they try to get false witnesses to come, and they have to question the witnesses separately, but they couldn't get two false witnesses whose stories lined up. And you have to have two or three witnesses whose testimony agrees. Otherwise, you cannot carry out capital punishment as here. So they can't find liars whose testimony, whose lies agree. Verse 60, and the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, do you answer nothing? What is it that these men testify against you? But Jesus kept silent and answered nothing. Again, the high priest asked him, saying to him, are you the Christ? Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed? Notice here, blessed, here's another synonym showing that they don't use God's name. We'll see several of those coming in the next few verses. Are you the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God is what they mean, but they use a euphemism for that. Jesus said, I am. So notice, they've had a number of false witnesses, but their false witnesses, their testimony doesn't agree. So they don't have anything to convict Jesus on until Jesus himself says what he says next. I am the Christ, and you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power. Again, a euphemism for God. Here's another one. And coming with the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, what further need do we have of witnesses? You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they all condemned him to be deserving of death. Then some began to spit on him and to blindfold him and to beat him and to say to him, prophesy. And the officers struck him with the palms of their hands. They're slapping him across the face, in other words. So they are finally, they have evidence to convict Jesus of a capital crime, which is blasphemy. The false witnesses didn't work. So Jesus himself gives them the ammunition that they need. Let's see, now we'll skip down to, bottom of page 118. Other details here that we don't have time to cover about Peter denying Jesus three times after he had earlier said that same evening, I will never deny you. So it doesn't require much explanation. She will just skip on. Down to page 118, Luke's account, Luke 22, and verse 66 at the bottom of the page. As soon as it was day, the elders of the people, both chief priests and scribes, came together and led him into their council, saying, if you are the Christ, tell us. But he said to them, if I tell you, you will by no means believe. And if I also ask you, you will by no means answer me or let me go. Hereafter the Son of Man will sit at the right hand of the power of God. Then they all said to him, are you then the Son of God? So he said to them, you rightly say that I am. So here's a parallel account to what we just read earlier. They said, what further testimony do we need? For we have heard it ourselves from his own mouth. Next part here on the next page, page 119, I'll just summarize this, where Jesus finally, now he sees what is happening. Now he sees that Jesus is condemned and is going to die. And he is filled with remorse. And he goes out and he commits suicide. He hangs himself. So again, straightforward. I'll just mention the 30 pieces of silver is the price of a slave again. So they end up taking that 30 pieces of silver and buy a field there for burying people in. Matthew 27 verse 10, where it's quoted there, and gave them for the potter's field as the Lord directed me. That's from Zechariah 11. 12 and 13, if you want to write that in your notes, Zechariah 11, 12 and 13. Okay, continuing, bottom of page 119 from John's account, John 18, verse 28. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium, and it was early morning. But they themselves did not go into the praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. So here they have no qualms about sentencing an innocent man to death, but they're not going to set foot in the house of a Gentile, lest they should be defiled and not able to eat the Passover. So you can see something about their mindset, their priorities that Jesus has so condemned on a number of times leading up to this. Pilate then went out to them, verse 29, and said, what accusation do you bring against this man? They answered and said to him, if he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you. So obviously he's guilty, or we wouldn't have brought him to you. Why do they do this? Well, they do this because the Jews, under Roman administration, they cannot carry out capital punishment themselves. Only the Romans can authorize or approve or carry that out. So they have to get Pilate's permission. So we see quite a bit of manipulation going on in this section here. Luke 23 and verse 2 adds, and they began to accuse him, saying, and notice, so read this carefully, we found this fellow perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king. So notice what happens here. they have just convicted him in the Sanhedrin of what? Of what crime? Of blasphemy. Blasphemy, the Romans don't care at all about blasphemy. That's a matter of Jewish law. Deal with that yourselves. The charges they bring before Pontius Pilate are not paying taxes to Caesar, which is sedition. And saying that he is Christ, a king. What's that? That's treason. That's inciting rebellion against Rome. And if you incite rebellion against Rome, you get crucified. So they have to lie about the charges. They change the charges. Now back to John 18, verse 31, the bottom of the page. Then Pilate said to them, "You take him and judge him according to your law." So again, Pilate's suspicious of them, and rightly so. He knows there's something funny going on there. So he says, "You take him and judge him according to your law." Therefore the Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." So again, they don't have that legal authority. "That the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spoke, signifying by what death he would die." How did the Jews execute people? Stoning to death. How do the Romans execute people? By crucifixion. How does Jesus have to die? According to prophecy. By being lifted up. We've seen that a number of times. He has to be crucified. Now, when some of those prophecies were recorded, that was 1,000 years before. It was centuries before crucifixion was even invented as a method of capital punishment. And yet God knows how Jesus is going to die 1,000 years in the future. Continuing on, then Pilate entered the praetorium again, called Jesus, and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered him, "Are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you a king then?" Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no fault in him at all." Notice, interesting here, Jesus is, we talked last time about Lamb Selection Day. The Lamb has to be declared perfect to be a suitable sacrifice. Here we see Pilate saying he's spotless. He's not guilty of anything. He has to be declared pure and clean and spotless so he can be the perfect Passover lamb. Matthew 27, verse 12 through 14 adds, "And while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he answered nothing. Then Pilate said to him, 'Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?' But Jesus answered him not one word, so that the governor marveled greatly." Let's see, now let's skip to Mark 15, verses 6 through 15, bottom part of page 121. We'll skip through part of that, the part about him going to Herod Antipas, who is the local Jewish ruler under Pilate. He goes there, doesn't respond to anything. Antipas sends him back to Pilate. So what we see, you've heard the old saying, politics make strange bedfellows, and indeed it does here, because here these two were formerly enemies and rivals, but after this day, they become fast friends, united by one thing, which is the contemptible way that they treat Jesus. So continuing in Mark 15, verse 6, "Now at the feast, he, Pilate, was accustomed to releasing one prisoner to them, whomever they requested. And there was one named Barabbas, who was chained with his fellow rebels. They had committed murder in the rebellion." This man, Barabbas, may have been a zealot. We talked earlier about the zealot movement that is starting to gain ground. These are the people who want to raise up an army and kick the Romans out by force. And the same Greek words that are used to describe Barabbas here in the Gospels are the same words used by Josephus, the Jewish historian, to describe the zealot. So it's quite possible, if not probable, that notice it says here they had committed murder in the rebellion. There's apparently some outbreak of violence, and Barabbas is a murderer as a result of people who were killed in that. Then the multitude, crying aloud, began to ask Pilate to do just as he had always done for them. Continuing in Luke's account, Luke 23, verse 13, bottom of the page, then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, "You have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning these things, those things of which you accuse him." So again, Pilate declares him innocent, pure, sinless. "I have found no fault in this man." No, neither did Herod. Herod also didn't find anything to execute him for. "For I sent you back to him, and indeed nothing deserving of death has been done by him." He's clearly declared not guilty. Switching over to Matthew's account now on the next page, Matthew 27 and verse 17. "Therefore, when they had gathered together, Pilate said to them, 'Whom do you want me to release to you, Barabbas or Jesus, who is called Christ?' For he knew that they had handed him over because of envy." So Pilate sees through this charade. He sees that the chief priests, the scribes, the Pharisees view Jesus as a threat, and they're just trying to have him murdered by Roman authority to get rid of him. Quite a remarkable statement. Verse 19, "While he was sitting in the judgment seat, his wife, Pilate's wife, sent to him, saying, 'Have nothing to do with that just man, for I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him.'" The Romans, I mentioned here, were very superstitious people. They believed a great deal in dreams and omens and, you know, examining the entrails of an animal before they go into battle or make a big decision or something like that. So they're very superstitious, and we see this reflected in his wife, her comment, what she says here regarding her dreams. "Have nothing to do with this this just man, because I've had dreams that are uncomfortable to me because of him." Verse 20, "But the chief priests and elders persuaded the multitudes that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. And the governor answered and said to them, 'Which of the two do you want me to release to you?' And they said, 'Barabbas.'" Now, I should mention something here about this crowd, because, and some people make a big deal about how fickle the Jews are, because just a couple of days earlier, as he comes into Jerusalem on Lamb Selection Day, what are they doing? They are proclaiming him king, proclaiming him Messiah, shouting, "Hosanna, save us." They're laying down their clothing and palm branches in front of him. And some people will say, and you know, this shows how fickle people are, because now the same people are calling for his death. Well, are they the same people? Are they the same people? When is this event taking place? It's taking place very early in the morning, a little bit after sunrise, after people have had the Passover the night before. Most people are probably sleeping in. Notice who is manipulating this crowd. It's the chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees, the elders, as it says in verse 20. "The chief priests and elders persuaded the multitude that they should ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus." Who has gathered up this crowd here to demand Jesus' death? The guilty parties are the chief priests and elders. They have gone out and rounded up their supporters, maybe their family members, their friends, and that's who, there's a phrase that's used occasionally today, rent a mob. you go out and you hire protesters to go out and protest against this or that issue. This is kind of what's going on here. They've gone out and rounded up their own friends and supporters to come and back them up, like the multitudes are demanding Jesus' death, when in reality it's them. And they're manipulating the people, and they're trying to manipulate Pilate, but he sees through it. The governor answered and said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release to you?" And they said, "Barabbas." So, again, this is it's two different crowds, is the bottom line. The average people do welcome Jesus as king as he comes into Jerusalem on Lamb Selection Day. This is a hand-picked crowd. A handpicked crowd that the Jerusalem religious establishment has stirred up, maybe even paid off to be there early in the morning to help them condemn Jesus. I think that's really what is going on. It's not the same people, it's two different groups of people. And keep in mind also that at Passover time, a million or more people may have come or would have come to Jerusalem for the Passover. So it would be very, very, very easy to suppose these are two totally different groups of people at different times. Continuing with John's account, bottom of page 122, John 19, verse 1. "So then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him." And this probably took place, a little bit about geography. They have come to Herod's palace, and we know where that is from archaeology in Jerusalem. Here to orient, here's the big temple platform, the temple itself, the Antonia Fortress. This is the Tyropian Valley down in here that's largely filled in. It's just a shallow depression at this point. And up here on the western side of the city, the upper city, the upper hill, is the rich section of town. And this is probably somewhere in here is where Jesus kept the Passover with his disciples, because again, they've got a dining room that'll seat at least 13 people. They've got the triclinium that we've talked about, which was in the wealthy houses. And Herod's palace, we know now, was over here near the outer wall of the city of Jerusalem at that time. And they found parts of the foundations of this. And Herod the Great built this, but he's long gone. He's been dead 30 plus years. But the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, he normally lives at Caesarea up on the coast, about 30 miles away. So when he comes to Jerusalem for the feast, where does he stay? He stays in the nicest place in town, which is Herod's old palace. So now it's become his residence when he comes to town. So when it talks about the praetorium here, a term that's mentioned several times, very near this are these three large towers. If you go to Jerusalem today, one of these is called the Tower of David. It's misnamed, doesn't have anything to do with King David, but the remains of one of these towers is there, and they found the foundations of the others. But these are manned by Roman soldiers because this guards one of the main gates into the city. So this is just no more than 100 yards, 150 yards from Pilate's residence here. So he has him scourged by the Roman soldiers. So this is very close. They are, you know, 5-minute walk, if even that, from Pilate's residence. So scourging was a horrible, terrible ordeal. A victim would die just from blood loss and shock and trauma, just from the scourging. We'll discuss that a little bit more later on. And the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. If any of you have ever had a cut on your head or something, head wounds bleed profusely because the blood vessels are so close to the surface. There's just very little tissue between your skull and your skin. So he's going to be bleeding profusely from this crown of thorns jammed down onto his head. So they put on him a crown to mock him, and they put on him a purple robe, and they said, "Hail, King of the Jews," and they strike him. They slap him and beat him again with their hands. Pilate then went out again and said to them, "Behold, I am bringing him out to you that you may know that I find no fault in him." So they have scourged Jesus, and Pilate brings Jesus before the crowd, hoping they will come to their senses and realize this man has suffered an incredible amount, and now they won't demand anything further. They realize this man has suffered horribly through the scourging. And again, he says, "I find no fault in him." Then Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and purple robe. And again, why do the Roman soldiers do this? Well, to mock him as king of the Jews. He claims to be a king. So we'll, and we won't go through all the accounts, but yeah, they mock him and insult him and so on. So they're dressing him in purple like a king and putting a crown on his head and mocking him. And they give him a staff also, a reed to hold like a king's scepter, but it's all humiliating and mocking. So Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Therefore, when the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." Again, Pilate declares him innocent. The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die because he made himself the Son of God." Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid. And he went again into the praetorium and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Then Pilate said to him, Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have the power to crucify you and power to release you, to set you free?" Jesus answered, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin." From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, "If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar," against the emperor, the Roman emperor. So now what is the Jewish religious establishment doing? I mentioned earlier, they're manipulating. They're trying to manipulate Pilate. He sees through it, sees it's all trumped up charges, that they're motivated by their envy and their jealousy. But now what do? Now they threaten blackmail against Pontius Pilate, implying that if he releases Jesus, they will go and tell Caesar that Pilate released a man who said that he was the king and not the emperor. And that could get Pilate removed from office, possibly even executed as complicit in a plot to overthrow the emperor. So these people will stop at nothing, absolutely nothing. I might mention this too. Pontius Pilate, we know a little bit about him from Josephus. Josephus does not say good things about Pilate, said he's greedy, he's mean, he's cruel. We read a day or two ago about the blood, the Galileans who came to offer sacrifice, and Pilate mingled their blood with the blood of their sacrifices. Pilate came into office, I don't remember the exact year, early 20s, so he's been in office not quite a decade at this time. One of the first things he did when he came into office is the Roman soldiers, the escort with him, came in bearing their standards, which are kind of like their military flags with the big eagles on top of the poles and the banners of the legions and all of this. And he took those and he put them on the, let me back up a little bit, yeah, here on the on the walls of the Fortress Antonia overlooking the temple, and that infuriated the Jews because these eagles are idols, they're graven images. And there was a riot that broke out, and I don't remember how many people, it was several hundred or several thousand Jews were slaughtered in the riot that broke out. So that's how Pilate begins his reign as governor there in Judea, and this gets him in hot water because the Jews send a delegation to Rome and saying, "We don't want this guy that you have appointed governor here." And so that's how he started his reign. There was, with all of that bloodshed, again, there was the Galileans whose blood he mingled with their sacrifices. There's another incident. So Pilate at this point is on probation, you might say. He's on a very short leash from Rome. And he knows that if he blows it one more time, he may well likely get recalled, replaced as governor, retired, maybe sent to the equivalent of Siberia or something, or worst case, executed, or have all of his property confiscated and declared an enemy of the state and be in really bad shape. So this blackmail is a very powerful weapon they use against him. And he is under pressure. He is susceptible to those threats by the people there. So that's a little bit of the historical background that's not spelled out in the Gospels, but it's very real. So again, they will stop at nothing to be sure that Jesus has to die. Verse 13, when Pilate therefore heard that saying, that they're going to accuse him of treason to Rome, he brought Jesus out and sat down in the judgment seat in a place is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Now it was the preparation day of the Passover in about the sixth hour. And he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." But they cried out, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." They're even denying God as their king, in other words. And switching over to Matthew 27, verse 24, page 124. When Pilate saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult, a riot, is about to break out, he took water and washed his hands before the multitude, saying, "I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it." Then all the people answered and said, "His blood be on us and on our children." Then he released Barabbas to them, and when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Now that's where we will pick up the story tomorrow with Jesus' crucifixion. Going to do it from a bit of a different angle, as we'll see tomorrow, because there is a very detailed prophecy Jesus' crucifixion. So rather read through the gospel accounts, we'll read through that prophecy, and it describes the crucifixion not from the eyewitnesses, but from Jesus' own perspective of what is happening to him, what he is feeling, what he is experiencing as he's being crucified. So we'll pick it up there tomorrow morning. So have a good rest of the day. We'll see you then.